Come on. You gotta admit you've thought of that, you know? Jeez, I wonder what would happen if I got up and opened up this door at 32,000 feet. There's probably a Family Guy skit like that, right? Must be. Oh. Well, I'm glad they stopped him, you know. I guess, you know, some people, they get an idea like that in their head and then they just can't let go of it, right? Oh, man. I may be flying through the air higher than an eagle soars at 450 miles an hour, but oh, God dang, I want to pull that lever. Oh, man, I probably just got myself on the no-fly list for the rest of my life, right? All right, well, anyway. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I got a fever, man. I can feel it. I must have some kind of germs living inside me right now. I'm feeling germy. That's all right. I'll just sweat while I do my show. And my throat will hurt. But that's all right, you know. What do you care? Right, exactly. So, today on the show, John Glazer is going to be here to talk about Palestine and Israel and John Kerry's failure. I'm so surprised that John Kerry failed at doing something. Gotta admit, he's a successful politician. Oh, well. No good at being a statesman, that's all. John Glazer is going to be on to tell us a sad story. It's not like it's anything you didn't predict. It's only now your prediction has come true. Yeah, the peace process, it's a joke, just like you already knew it was. Only now proven again. All right. And then, also, I got about 150 invites out. No, that's an exaggeration. I don't know, 10 or something? Let me see. I'm still waiting to hear back from 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, at least 4 people haven't answered yet. Told me no yet. Got a lot of no's, though. Everybody's really busy today. Either that or they all hate me, which, you know, is possible. But I got emails out. I've got voicemails left. But anyway, that's all right, because I'll just interview myself. It's going to be great. I got a ton of news to talk about, including look at these goons with their rifles running around in Ukraine right now. I'm watching the BBC, so of course it's imperial propaganda, although they have a lot more actual, at least factoids, if not real facts. Still, they do better on the factoids than CNN. This is my new leaf. I'm turning it over. I'm watching the BBC during the show. I mean, they still talk, you know, true crime stories and celebrity news and all the rest of the same crap. It's barely better at all, really. They just sound smarter because they sound British. Not really. Not to me. That's what people say, though. All right, well, and see, this is the other thing. They cover the royalty even more than on CNN, which is already way too much. That's the real Achilles heel of the BBC. Like, I care at all about some prince and his baby. Oh, God. Send the SAS to kill me. I would prefer that. Thank you. Today on the show, war in Ukraine? World War? The end of mankind? I don't know. We're going to talk about that. And then also, Chelsea Manning, the bogus Afghan election, the American invasion of Africa, price inflation, after the fact, justification of the Libya war in the form of a Showtime documentary, the Bundy Ranch and the Nazi murderer and all these things coming up on the show today. All right, first of all, let's talk about the Ukraine situation here. Basically, the deal is this. Ever since the American-backed coup in Kiev in February and the removal of Yanukovych from power, the government of the West, I mean, to whatever degree they've solidified their power in the West, I guess they have, and they've teamed up with the Svoboda and Right Sector neo-Nazis in order to do so. But in the East, they're just a name. It's still the name of the country, but it's not the name of the government there, or it ain't a real government there. They haven't really been able to consolidate power. And so what's happened in the kind of semi-lawless zone is that pro-Russian protesters, and plausibly, possibly, but I don't know if it's really proven so far, but possibly supported by actual Russian intelligence, why not, are, you know, seizing town halls. They're basically, they're doing the same thing that the Americans did in backing the protests in the Maidan since last November. You know, probably at least with money and some coordination and what have you. And so, what's happening is, hey, you know, your state monopoly on force only exists where it really exists. And, you know, an illusion is nice, but if somebody calls your bluff is called. And that's the position that the new government of Ukraine is in, is they don't really rule the eastern half of the country. And they've been threatening the protesters and, well, whoever they are, the armed gunmen who are patrolling around and seizing territory in the east, that they better back down or else, which that is what it means to be a government. Now, there are rumors that, you know, the hashtag on Twitter going around is, invasion Ukraine or something like that. And they're saying that Russian special forces and military people are already running around in the east, you know, to a greater degree than maybe some of the coverage would lead you to believe. And so the question is, of course, you know, what happens if the Ukrainian government in Kiev decides to push its luck and force its will in eastern Ukraine? You know, I read one poll, which I don't know if it's legit or not, may well be, that said that really only about a quarter of the people of eastern Ukraine support the people who are seizing the government buildings. Well, they better hurry up and seize them back then, if they really believe in a unified Ukraine, because as it looks right now, the separatists are seizing power. And as it looks right now, and I don't really know, but it seems like if the Ukrainian government goes to war for the East, then that will be all the excuse that Putin needs, even if he's provoking it. You could call it him baiting the trap if you want to. That would be the pretext that he would need to invade eastern Ukraine. So at this point, there's somebody over at the American Conservative Magazine wrote an article talking about how the new leaders of Ukraine learned the hard lessons about revolution. Or the hard lesson about revolution, which is once you start one, it's kind of hard to stop it sometimes. And so they're saying, yay, all right, we won. We're the guys. And yet everybody on their quote-unquote side who doesn't really like the way they're doing it, they can withdraw from the coalition whenever they want. It's a new day every day for people to live up to their end of whatever arrangements are made, or to change their terms if that's what they want to do. And then, of course, you have a situation where in the East, they're simply mimicking the Maidan movement and seizing power from themselves in the same way that happened in the West. Just go ahead and occupy the building and who's going to kick you out of it, kind of a thing. And, you know, getting it done. And then who knows, all the different pictures of, you know, big tough guys dressed in black with black ski masks, aiming rifles here and shooting them there. You can't necessarily trust the mainstream news narration of who's who and exactly what they're doing. But I think, you know, it's perfectly plausible that the Russians are, you know, fomenting a move. And, you know, the port there, not just the Crimean Peninsula, but the Black Sea port, what's on the other side of Odessa from Crimea, I guess. That might be a nice little prize for Putin to take. If he wants to take the east, might as well go ahead and take that port. And then the real threat of war comes not from any actual threat to American interests at all. The biggest threat of war, and I mean between America and Russia on this, would simply be Barack Obama and John Kerry facing heat from the right for not being tough enough. It's the perennial problem of a Democrat, no matter who they kill and what lies they tell. It's never enough for the right wing. They'll always attack him from the right. They'll always, you know, just like John McCain calling John Kerry a sissy all day the other day. Poor John Kerry said, "Oh, I'm hurt and surprised and offended. I thought John Kerry was my friend and he said all this stuff." Yeah, well, that's the game. So, they could get us into a war. You know, when somebody like Eric Margolis says, "Hey, this is shaping up to be how World War I started 100 years ago and all those millions of people died and it ruined everything for everyone," I think we should take that serious. Eric Margolis is a hell of a student of history, recent and long-term, and current events as well. And he's pointing out, as a great many experts have pointed out in expert-type journals, it's not... I don't think they're talking like this on the Lehrer NewsHour or on Brian Williams or anything like that. But if you read, even on the Wall Street Journal, or at least the Washington Post editorial page, they published Henry Kissinger urging everyone to cool their jets about this. Over at thenationalinterest.com, you can read all these realist wonks talking about how America picked this fight and ought to back down since we've caused a crisis where we needn't have one at all. If only they would say that on TV. I think the American people already agree anyway, though. Don't you? Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, check it out. Agents France Press reporting. Breaking. Guardian U.S. Washington Post. Share Pulitzer Prize for Snowden revelations. Congratulations to Glenn Greenwald. He sure deserves it. It's Greenwald and Ewan McCaskill. I think that's how you say it. Oh, I guess this guy is saying Greenwald and Poitras didn't win the Pulitzer. That just The Guardian did, in a way that was a slight at Greenwald? Is that how that works? Huh. Well, here, let me retweet this, and then I'm going to head over to Glenn Greenwald's blog and see if he's saying thank you, or hey, what are my feelings, or what? Let me see here. GGR, well, there he is right there, Glenn Greenwald. And he says, Oh, 22 hours ago was his latest tweet. So I don't know. I wonder what that means. It's just a breaking tweet. They had no link. I don't believe they had a link to a story about it yet, did they? No, they don't. Just breaking headline. Guardian U.S. Washington Post. Share Pulitzer Prize. That's got to mean Greenwald, right? They can't just give it to the Guardian and not Greenwald. Right? There you go. The Guardian. Latest. Pulitzer. Oh, 18 minutes ago. Here we go. The Guardian. This is at the Guardian, theguardian.com. The Guardian and the Washington Post have been awarded the highest accolade in U.S. journalism, winning the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for their groundbreaking articles on the National Security Agency's surveillance activities based on the leaks of Edward Snowden. The award, announced in New York on Monday, comes 10 months after The Guardian published the first report based on leaks from Snowden, revealing the agency's bulk collection of U.S. citizens' phone records. The Pulitzer Committee praised The Guardian for its revelation of widespread secret surveillance by the National Security Agency, helping through aggressive reporting to spark a debate about the relationship between the government and the public over issues of security and privacy. In the series of articles that ensued, teams of journalists at The Guardian and The Washington Post published the most substantial disclosures of U.S. government secrets since the Pentagon Papers on the Vietnam War in 1971. I don't know. It's debatable. I'd say about equal with Manning. It's not, Manning's stuff wasn't as high level, but it was a lot more wide-ranging and still extremely important stuff. Anyway. At The Guardian, the reporting was led by Glenn Greenwald, Ewan McCaskill, and filmmaker Laura Poitras. And at The Washington Post by Barton Gellman, who also cooperated with Poitras. All four journalists were honored with a George Polk Journalism Award last week for their work on the NSA story. The NSA revelations have reverberated around the world and sparked a debate over the, yeah. Am I right? Do I understand this right? That they did this in a way so that you're not supposed to be able to say Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Glenn Greenwald? Is that what that is? They're giving the prize to the newspaper and not to the reporters? Is that how they do it? Did they not give the Pulitzer Prize to Woodward and Bernstein or whoever the hell won it for whatever crap? I mean, I don't know. Why would they do the right thing? I read this article the other day, man. What was it? The Daily Caller, one of these, about how, you know, there's a real dilemma. It's a real crisis there on the Pulitzer jury. Because, you know, on one hand, these are some really great stories that we've gotten out of the Snowden documents and the reporting that's been done here by Greenwald, Poitras, Gellman, etc. But on the other hand, the U.S. government says that Edward Snowden's a traitor. And so, how's the Pulitzer Committee supposed to decide between that? What they know is right, or what the Empire says is right, which is the opposite of that. Oh, it's really hard to decide, because what the Empire thinks is the definition of what right is, isn't it? We the people and all of that? Oh, their cognitive dissonance almost blowed up their brains. And I guess, is it, do I really have this right? Tell me I'm misunderstanding this, chat room. Somebody help me with this. Is this the compromise? Is that what I'm looking at here? Well, we'll give the Pulitzer to The Guardian and The Post instead of Greenwald, McCaskill, Poitras, Gellman? Dude. That ain't fair now. Come on now. Now, maybe I got it wrong and I just don't know how Pulitzers work. Oh, good. Tom Woods interviewed Gareth Porter, huh? That's great. I'm so excited to hear that. I wonder if Tom read his book. Did Tom read his book? All right, well, I don't know. All right, well, let's see. What's the time, man? Okay, I got time. Congratulations, Glenn. I don't know Poitras, so congratulations, Miss Poitras. Mr. McCaskill, Mr. Gellman. But yeah, I mean, hey, is this even debatable at all? Who was the runner-up for this after the Snowden story? And, you know, I mean, there's been some good stories over the past year. The AP's done some great work. A lot of reporters have done some great work over the last year, but I don't know, I guess Seymour Hersh, he should have been in second place, right? But no, what happened with Snowden here, this is the most beautiful thing ever. I mean, think about this, seriously. It's been almost a year now. We've got a little bit of hindsight, a little bit of distance from events. What for, so we can check them out? Here, this guy, former CIA guy, you know, and I think the right-wingers, when they smear him, they sort of neglect to really cover their bases, which would have to include that Edward Snowden is a really straight-laced kid, and apparently some kind of Republican, maybe just barely, but here's a kid who believed in the system. He went and worked for the CIA. It's not like he was a mole the whole time for some foreign government or some crap like the Republicans say. He was a highly valued member of the Central Intelligence Agency. And then he went to work for the NSA, and he was doing good work for them, what they wanted done. He was a contractor working for Dell and then for Booz Allen Hamilton. And then he came up simply against a crisis of conscience. You know, the Constitution of the United States, whether you like it or not, whatever you think of it, and maybe you think this shouldn't be, but at least the theory of the way things go here that people are made to accept is that this is the charter of this government. This is the law that allows this national government to exist. And it is bound by the words in it. So, for example, when it says that they cannot appropriate money for the military for more than 2 years at a time, they can't appropriate money for the military for more than 2 years at a time. Because that's the law. Even if you think that's stupid, that's the law. Change the Constitution, or I guess do a coup d'etat and throw it out or whatever, but that's the law. Well, the Fourth Amendment is the law. Simple as that. The Fourth Amendment says, in effect, we will allow you to exist so long as you stay within these guidelines, and you cross them, at least your authority on those issues are moot. And if you push it too far, remember, the Fourth Amendment, those protections against general warrants, those are protections that are drawn from the experience of the American Revolution. It was the general warrants, the writs of assistance, warrantless searches of people's houses, that did as much as anything to precipitate the American Revolution. It wasn't just the tea smugglers. It was regular people being pushed around by militarists without warrants. And the National Security Agency, I will remind you, is part of the military. That's why it's always run by a general, not a civilian, or an admiral, not a civilian. And so Edward Snowden said, you know what, forget this, man, I'm telling Glenn Greenwald on you. You know, what journalist in the West could he possibly count on to make sure to get this right? If not on every last technical detail, though I've never seen any real substantial criticism, but it's not that he picked Glenn Greenwald because Glenn Greenwald is such a, you know, hardcore technology head. That's not the case. But he's hardcore on the Bill of Rights. And you can just tell. I mean, the guy's Clark Kent, man. You can't compromise him. You can't threaten him. He's going to do the work. Simple as that. And then I love the whole story about how Greenwald wouldn't answer the dude for a while. Because, oh, man, this guy, he wants me to install some PGP key, this, that, whatever the hell. I don't know, man. And he wouldn't get around to installing the encrypted software that he needed to install. Snowden had to go ahead and get in touch with Poitras and have her get in touch with Greenwald and make him do this. They all go and meet in Hong Kong and all. Isn't it great? I think it's just great. And the stories that have come out of it, pure horror. Go to, just Google this, EFF NSA, and look at that primary sources page. Blow your mind. Catch up. All right, it's the Scott Horton Show. John Glazer in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I had to make a phone call. All right. I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. And that's where I will be keeping the archive of this interview you're about to hear. Welcome back to the show, John Glazer. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me back.
Well, you're welcome. Very happy to have you here. Everybody, you know John. He writes on the blog at antiwar.com and also for the Huffington Post and the Washington Times. You see that? Left, right, and libertarian, all wrapped up in one writing career there going on. Perfect. Very happy to have you back on the show. And you've written some things here for the anti-war blog about the peace process going on over there in Israel-Palestine. And a little bit of accidental honesty, or was it deliberate honesty from our Secretary of State on an issue, John? Really?
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether it was accidental or whether it was deliberate. But the fact is that John Kerry, when speaking before, I believe, a House committee, described why the peace talks fell apart this past week. And what he says was that, contrary to what the media reported and contrary to what was coming out of Israel and contrary to what a lot of people in Congress were saying, it was not that the Palestinians decided to go sign a bunch of international treaties against the wishes of Israel, and therefore, you know, they did this deliberately to foil the whole peace talks thing. Rather, it was the case that Israel did two things. It, first of all, refused to fulfill its promise to release Palestinian prisoners, and then a couple days later announced the construction of 700 new settlement units in East Jerusalem. These two things happened prior to the PLO's announcement of its pursuit of 15 international treaties, and therefore this is precisely what collapsed the negotiations. Notably, the Palestinians didn't say, I'm not going to negotiate anymore. They just said, we're going to take this step. This step being something that is simply, you know, something that builds upon their achievement of getting a non-member observer status at the UN. It just builds on their pursuit of statehood, because obviously what is clear from the past negotiations, and this round in particular, is that Israel is not interested in reaching a deal that will lead to a Palestinian state. The whole purpose is to make that possibility impossible. And so, you know, it was good that it was kind of an interesting thing that John Kerry said this in front of the House. Of course, you know, there are people in Israel and people here in the U.S. who jumped on him for it and said the whole, you know, we've heard this trope before, and you throwing Israel under the bus, blaming Israel first, and this kind of stuff. And then John Kerry's office, the State Department, said, no, we weren't trying to blame anyone. We were just trying to be even-handed, describing what happened, and, you know, fluffing the feathers of the Israelis.
Well, the plagiarized Stephen Colbert, Truth has a well-known anti-Israel bias.
That's right, yeah. It apparently does. But, you know, the truth is that these negotiations were doomed from the get-go. And that's because, you know, the short reason is because Israel opposes a Palestinian state. And, of course, that's the purpose of the negotiations, to build a state for Palestine and security for Israel. But the long story is essentially that the Netanyahu government has added on a bunch of demands to their final status that they know are completely unacceptable to the PLO. And, in fact, contrary to the U.S.'s own statements about what it supports and what it doesn't. So, for example, instead of a broad agreement that the 1967 lines are generally what we're shooting for, with minor and mutual adjustments and trades and, you know, land swaps and so forth, instead of that, Netanyahu's saying, no, 1967 lines are out. They are not anything I want to have anything to do with. In fact, what Israel has said is that their demands for security include perpetually occupying the Jordan Valley. Now, Netanyahu asked for this to be Israeli occupation, and then as a compromise, as you can call it that, John Kerry said, oh, okay, we'll try to do maybe international occupation, you know, UN forces and something like this. But of course, that situation just prolongs the occupation, which these negotiations are trying to stop. This is what Palestine is involved in the negotiations to end. The other thing that they, and one other thing that they insisted upon, Israel insisted upon, was that the Palestinian side recognized Israel as the state for the Jews, the homeland of the Jewish people. Now, the problem with that is, it's a tweaking of a previous demand. The previous demand was that the Palestine recognized the legitimacy of Israel, right? Which they did. Palestine did it in 1988 and then again in 1993. But now, since they acceded to that, you know, Netanyahu has to demand more in order to make it seem like the Palestinians are the ones being these intransigent, you know, rejectionists, negotiators. And so he said, no, recognize us as the homeland of the Jewish people, just, you know, sort of twisting that knife a little more. And of course, this is unacceptable to Palestinians. However, all of that, what I just said, was not any reason why the latest talks fell apart, because the whole thing was so doomed that John Kerry said, all right, what we're going to do is do an interim agreement. We're going to do these small little steps and then agree to a talk for another year because the deadline was coming up at the end of April. And so this is what actually made the whole talk fall apart. These interim agreements, these small steps that both Israel and Palestine said they would agree to, Israel didn't agree to them. In fact, they passed the deadline on which they said they would do these things, and then they fell apart. And you know, this is the same story we hear every single time. Israel is now trying to say it was Palestine, and of course the whole world knows, anyone who cares to pay attention to facts, that Israel is the one that exploded these talks.
Yeah. Well, same as always. I mean, I even recognized when I was a little kid, just from hearing it occasionally on the news, the way they always talked about the peace process. It never meant peace talks. Yeah, they're having some peace talks. They're going to go and sit down at a table, and they're going to work out some peace talks. It always meant we're going to goof around and pretend like we're ever going to have peace talks someday, forever. It's been like this since, you know, well, since 67.
Like you say,
these interim deals. Well, let's come up with a deal that says that we'll have some more meetings next year, okay? We'll call it a framework deal. It'll be a roadmap to a framework to a bunch of nonsense.
Right. Essentially, the negotiations are a sort of a way for Israel to continue to gradually annex the West Bank and fulfill its dreams of a greater Israel. But under the backdrop of trying to negotiate and trying to, you know, settle this and give Palestine a state and all this stuff. So it's just, it's a way to sort of shift the debate. If Israel is engaged in quote-unquote negotiations or quote-unquote peace talks, then the international community and Washington in particular has absolutely no right to criticize Israel for anything it's doing, right? No policy of Israel can be criticized while negotiations are in process, because of course negotiations are very delicate. We want to be, you know, acceding to both sides and make it fair so that we can actually get something going. But of course, this is what Israel has done for decades. Yes, we'll agree to negotiations. Let's do it. Let's talk. Let's talk forever. In fact, let's talk for as long as possible, because that way we can continue to steal Palestinian land in the form of demolishing homes that have been there for generations and putting in place Jewish-only settlements that the Israeli government subsidizes, continue to, you know, arrest and torture Palestinian children, which Israel does, according to various UN and Human Rights Watch reports, you know, continue to bomb and starve the people of Gaza. You know, this is a process of gradual annexation, and everybody knows it. That's what's weird about this. You know, people talk about settlements that aren't helpful, or even people say they're illegal. Yeah, both of those things are true, but what do they mean? What is their purpose? Can anyone describe honestly that their purpose is for Israeli security? No, this is a colonial project. It's to change the demographics of the entire West Bank so that eventually at some point down the road, everyone just has to shrug and go, well, Palestine was a thing of the past. Now Israel is the only state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean.
Well, and that's where, you know, the second half of the Nakba takes place, too, because at some point they're just going to have to force march all those people out of there, probably just straight into the Jordan River or something.
Well, yeah, as the Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg has written, the right wing in the right wing in Israel wants the land, but not the people. And this is essentially, you know, this is the nuts and bolts of the problem Israel faces. If it could, and if it wouldn't get internationally condemned, it would just push everyone out of Palestine. It would just like it did in 48, just push everyone into Jordan, you know, forcibly exit everyone from the land and then repopulate it with Israelis, and then that'll be done. They can't do that because it's too drastic, but they do want that land. So their middle-of-the-road process is what I just described, which is a gradual annexation, gradual ethnic cleansing. That will say, okay, some point down the road, it'll just be too impossible to extricate Jews and Israelis from West Bank, so we'll just have to deal with it.
Right.
And unfortunately, that is likely to, succeed because of the power differential here. You know, the U.S. backs Israel. Who backs Palestine?
Right, nobody. Well, actually, sometimes the U.S., but we'll train them up an army, but then they just get to use it for internal security purposes, that kind of thing.
Right.
All right, well, so yeah, your point's well taken about, and, you know, I guess I can sit here and pretend and play devil's advocate and follow up, but I think you're right, that it is perfectly obvious that they just keep moving the goalposts, because the Israeli government... on this issue, at least, they're just dishonest brokers. They don't mean it when they say that they want peace. They don't mean it that when they say that they're willing to concede a damn thing in order to have peace. They're occupying the West Bank. What the hell do they need peace for? They got 35-foot tall walls and nobody can cross, or whatever, however tall they are, 100-foot tall.
You know, I wish you could play devil's advocate, but that's kind of my whole point, is that...
I mean, there's really not a case to make from their point of view, not one that I could, you know, get all the way through without laughing.
Well, what I mean is this: it's just so obvious. Like, it's not reported this way, and it's not talked about in this kind of language, but the settlements have no other purpose. They don't have a security purpose. They make Israel less secure. They don't have...
Even the Prime Minister calls the West Bank Judea and Samaria. It's not the West Bank of the Jordan River. That might be where some Palestinians live, but all that is Israel East, buddy.
The Likud Party Charter describes Jewish settlement in both the West Bank and Gaza as the realization of Zionist values.
Yeah, well, you know, on their way to the Euphrates River. All right, hold it right there, everybody. It's John Glazer from Antiwar.com. The Washington Times and the Huffington Post, antiwar.com/blog. We'll be back right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys. So I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with John Glazer. He's from Antiwar.com, The Huffington Post, and The Washington Times. And we're talking about Israel-Palestine here. And now, John, I saw a thing. You were talking about this new condition that the Israelis would get to control the Jordan Valley forever. And was it Mayor Dagon or one of these former Mossad heads who was talking recently about how completely ridiculous that is and how from the point of view, strictly from a Israeli national security policy point of view, we don't need the Jordan Valley. Who's going to invade? Jordan? or Iraq or Iran? Yeah, right. Like, they could even get there in the first place. And then, of course, Israel doesn't need to occupy the Jordan Valley to defend it at all. That's where, you know, all them American-bought F-16 fighter bombers come in handy. And troop transports and whatever else. This whole thing, I'm beating a dead horse here, but might as well. It's the kind of thing that sounds like maybe it's necessary, but no.
No, and actually, yeah, Dagon and Moshe, I can't pronounce any of these names, but Moshe Yaalon, who's the defense minister, both of them have said that, look, this demand that Israel, you know, or somebody occupy the Jordan Valley in perpetuity, that doesn't offer any security to Israel at all. They don't. They simply don't face anything like the kind of security environment that they faced, you know, pre-1967, where any of the Arab states around them could have, you know, invaded or even had pretenses to invade or anything like this. These are old justifications that Israel is superimposing onto the current negotiations in order to continue an occupation that they are desperate to continue. And it's not to, you know, ensure their security. It's not to make sure that armies of Arabs from either Jordan or Egypt or anywhere else are going to, you know, come over at the border into the West Bank or into Israel. This is just simply not the justification. Israel has military superiority over all of those states. It has it's unique in the whole Middle East region for having nuclear weapons. And none of that's going to happen. So it's not a threat. So the justification purely is you know, dressed up as a security justification as such, but it's not. It's a justification to continue the occupation and make sure that the Israeli army and the Jews that are settled there do not leave the West Bank, because that is the realization of Zionist values. You know, as I said before the break, the Likud Party Charter says that there should be no Palestinian Arab state to the west of the Jordan River. And therefore, the Jordan Valley is very important to maintain in Israeli control.
Well, you know, I kind of wonder sometimes whether I'm actually, in my own small way, accidentally helping to normalize the idea that eventually there's just going to be a big Trail of Tears march out of the West Bank, a second half of the Nakba type of a situation, because that sure doesn't ever seem to be the premise of anybody else's argument about this stuff. I mean, you mentioned the Likud platform. That's still... they would, you know, could be argued as just sort of aspirational, you know, next year in Jerusalem kind of a thing. But, you know, when Ehud Olmert or Barack Obama talk about this, I'm sure you saw Barack Obama's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, where this is some pretty tough talk, and he's saying, listen, you're going to end up having to annex the West Bank, but that's going to be your poison pill. I'm paraphrasing. You know, because you're going to end up being a demographic minority, and then it'll be an outright apartheid state. You know, you'll have your Jewish state, but you won't have your democracy anymore. And that's what Ehud Olmert says as well, the former prime minister, and I think he's still the defense minister, isn't he, in the Likud government, says that, you know, this is national suicide here, what we're doing. We're biting off more than we can chew. And so, but I guess... you know, the forced march is the only real explanation other than complete and abject stupidity that the plan would eventually be that, yeah, they're going to annex the West Bank, all right, but they'll keep a Jewish majority by simply expelling all the Palestinian Christians and Muslims who already live there.
I think there's a couple things going on. So first of all, it's true that there are some in the left wing in Israel that want negotiations on the basis of the 1967 borders and actually mean it when they say that eventually they would like to see a secure and Palestinian state living peacefully alongside Israel. The problem is that the Likud party, one of the most right-wing hawkish groups in Israel, is in power in government right now. And over the past couple of years, particularly under the Obama administration, there has been the rise of a smaller, not Likud, right-wing parties in Israel, getting more seats in the Knesset and all this kind of stuff. And they are very powerful politically. They're the kind of powerful that, in the U.S., when right-wing hawks and conservative talk radio and Fox News get on their soapboxes and scream that Obama's weak, so you have to do something on Ukraine, and then Obama, no matter how reluctant he is, maybe he says something, hawkish, and blah, blah, blah. So this is the kind of pressure that both Netanyahu and the whole of Israeli government leadership faces, because if they sort of show weakness and recede from the dream of greater Israel, they'll be called out by this extreme right wing. And so, I think the extreme right wing, including Likud, is not looking forward about the consequences of an eventual, expulsion program. They're not looking at those kinds of consequences, partly because I think they're just extremely ideological. And in addition to that sort of party analysis, I also think it's just, bureaucratic and military inertia. The occupation has been going on for decades now. Israelis are settled with it. They're okay with it. This is part of the way they live. This is their life. This is sort of just a perennial fact of their existence in Israel, that they have to have a massive standing army all around their borders in Palestine, conscription, all of this kind of stuff. And so they, too, do not question the direction that this seems to be going in. That's at least my speculation. There might be some voices, maybe it's the case that a moderate or left-wing government rises in Israel post-Netanyahu, and they sort of are more in good faith negotiations, and then there's a two-state solution. But, that would have to include incredible concessions of removing people hundreds of thousands of people from the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Incredible concessions of pulling back their military, all of this kind of stuff. Incredible concessions of, getting rid of the water resources and getting rid of the control of the water resource in the West Bank. This would be asking so much that even if that sort of leftish, moderate style leader that we're hypothetically talking about did rise and push for this, he or she would get so attacked by the populace in Israel that I don't think it would be doable. So, in terms of what's going to happen and what this sort of logically plays out as, which is, of course, bad for Israel, bad for the United States, bad for Palestine, bad for everyone, I don't think there's just a lot of people thinking very rationally about it. I think they're irrational. That's the nature of Zionism, We inhabit this land no matter what, no matter who stands in our way, and it goes back to what's was said in the Bible. So that's something you can't argue with, Zeus, Poseidon, God, Allah, Muhammad, Jesus, these are not things that are up for rational discussion. And when people fervently believe it so much, they're not going to be punctured by logic that says eventually you're going to have to come to a decision, and eventually this dream is going to die because there are actual people living there.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There's so many liberal Zionists like Max Blumenthal and others now who are former liberal Zionists who aren't really Zionists at all anymore, who say they want a one state, that there has to be a one state, multi-ethnic, freedom of religion based society there, because it's the Zionist project is already so it's moved so far to the right, as you say. The fact, to paraphrase it, the facts on the ground, such as they are basically irreversible. But it's interesting to me that I hope I can remember what my point was going to be, John. That Oh, yeah, as you mentioned earlier in the show, Yasser Arafat, and for that matter, the rest of the neighboring states, they all said, okay, fine, you conquered Palestine back in 1948, okay, but just go back to 1967 borders. And so where Allah and Jesus and all of this stuff about the Third Temple and this and that may be irreconcilable, the basic facts of the human beings who actually live in the Holy Land, it has been reconcilable this whole time. It's just that the Israelis have continued to create these facts on the ground that have made it an irreconcilable situation. I mean, if you look at how hard it was for Sharon to get the settlers out of the Gaza Strip, and that's much less important to the Bible-based kooks than Judea and Samaria are. And so, you know, I think as you're saying, there's so many settlers there now, it would be such a project, it would basically be impossible even if Yitzhak Rabin came back to get it done. So, but it didn't have to be this way. It's they blew up their own country because they're mean-spirited and stupid.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately how it looks. And, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the one-state solution idea. I am because it seems like the least bad of a bunch of bad options in a certain sense, because I don't see a two-state solution working out, because, of course, it's going to play out along the dynamics that it has so far. And, you know, it is a sort of facts-on-the-ground type of thing, and I think a liberal Zionist like Max Blumenthal, who are very critical of Israel and the occupation and so forth, sort of need to come to grips and, you know, drink some bad cough medicine and just say one-state solution is the most doable and best, the least bad option that we have.
Oh, well, you know, to be clear, that's what he thinks. That's his position, is that forget two states, it's got to be one. Forget the Zionist project, it should just be, you know, Israelistine over there or whatever, that kind of thing.
The problem with that is that it has even less support internationally than the two-state solution.
Right. Now, I'm sorry, let me ask you this real quick. We're already over time, but I got to get you to answer this because I screwed up and forgot to ask it over and over again.
Sure.
Which is that what difference is it really going to make for the Palestinians joining up all these international organizations?
So this is more of a symbolic thing.
Tell me in like 1 minute, tops.
Yeah, it's a symbolic move to try and build on their attainment of a non-observer member status at the UN. They want to be able to put their toys in place so that one day they can seek a status as a state unilaterally. And if they can, you know, be involved in all these international organizations and all these treaties, that makes it easier for them to do that. And that's a sort of wild card that they'll pull out if Israel continues to be intransigent.
All right. And I'm sorry, we got to leave it there. We're way over time here. But thank you so much for your time, John.
Okay.
All right, that's John Glazer from antiwar.com. The Washington Times, and the Huffington Post. And so here's some Fox News. We'll be right back with Eric Margolies in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Streaming at APS News Radio, Daily Paul Radio, my own site, scotthorton.org, Anomaly Radio. All over the goddamn place. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Keep all the interview archives there at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, including a whole bunch with Eric Margolies, because he knows a lot of things. He's the author of War at the Top of the World, as well as American Raj. And he writes for himself at ericmargolies.com, for lewrockwell.com, and also for uns.com. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm back with you. Happy to be back with you as the news just keeps pouring out.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what to make of it all. I guess, first of all, let's start with Ukraine. How about this? I'm scared to death. You tell me to chill out.
Do I guess who said that?
No, I just said that to you. Aren't you going to tell me to chill out? Seems like my government's going to get us into war with the Russians.
Well, it is very possible. It's frightening. People who are thinking and looking at the situation are worried as hell. You're right. This just reeks of World War I, the days before World War I, which I've studied in great depth. In fact, I have a Swiss degree in the subject, and it just gives me the willies because there's so many possible sparks that could ignite a shooting war over this ridiculous confrontation in Ukraine, where we, the United States, really have no business and no interest whatsoever.
All right, so we've got these protesters. I don't know who all. Some say there's Russian troops involved. Maybe they are Russian intelligence or Russian-sponsored locals or, I don't know, maybe locals seizing buildings and saying they want to vote on a referendum to secede from the Union over there in eastern Ukraine. Some of them even calling for Russian peacekeepers to come in and protect them from the Ukrainian government. At the same time, the Ukrainian government, the junta that America installed there, anyway, if you call them the Ukrainian government or not, they say that, you know, your time is up. I think they keep changing their deadlines, but they're saying, or they've threatened war, right? That they are going to rule eastern Ukraine, whether the eastern Ukrainians like it or not. And then it seems like pretty easy to see that at that point, Putin would go ahead and intervene and in the name of protecting pro-Russians and ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine from the West, at least. No?
Well, fortunately, President Putin is very cautious. And I'm hoping that he has the good sense not to get involved in a military clash there. If he does, I think he'll use Russian special forces and these kind of guys in unmarked uniforms and things. You know, don't you just hate it when the commies do exactly what we Americans have been doing for so long, that is subverting governments, overthrowing them, sending special forces into Libya to pretend there's a revolution going on there when in fact it's us overthrowing the government like we did in Iran, like we're trying to do in Syria. It's the pot calling the kettle black, and it really annoys us when the Russians take a page from our book.
Right. Well, and especially when they're doing the exact same thing, seizing the buildings and holding these mass protests and whatever, and to see John Kerry say, oh, well, you know, these aren't protesters. They're backed by a foreign power and whatever. It's just, come on, give us a few weeks before you're that hypocritical. You know what I mean?
They haven't caught anybody from Moscow talking on the telephone with the Kremlin about who they're going to appoint as the new leader in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, they got
like
better operational security than the Americans. There's, you know, that's actually, for me, that little part of the story is a big part of the story. In fact, maybe we talked about this before. Just the hubris of Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt to go on the way they did about orchestrating that regime change on what was apparently an unsecure line. Like, these people really think that they're, you know, 12 feet tall and live on Mount Olympus and all this, and how could mere mortals tap their phone, even if they're on an open line, you know?
One of my favorite books was written by the late Polish author Ryszard Kapuściński, and he wrote this wonderful book called King of Kings about the court of Haile Selassie, and he perfectly describes this phenomena of these people, once they get into power, suddenly their voices go down and their bodies become more square, and they don't look you in the eye, they're looking at the horizon, and it's just pulsating self-importance. And that's what these two-by-nothing neocons are doing in Washington. But I don't know how Kerry or any of these other people can accuse Russia with a straight face. After all, you know, we're not talking about Kansas or Texas. This is an area that used to be part of Russia. Yeah. And every invader that's tried to undermine and weaken Russia, the first thing they've done is tried to detach Ukraine.
Well, the hard part, too, is, and you know me, I'm an American, and so my biggest problem is with the American government that's always getting my country into trouble and that kind of thing. But Well, and in this case, they're getting the Ukrainian people into trouble. You know, as we talk great power politics, there are a lot of people in Ukraine who, you know, the reason that so many people in Ukraine speak Russian instead of Ukrainian is because the communists made it that way. The Russians, under the communist government, made it that way, and they rained holy terror on the people of Ukraine for, what, 75 years or something like that? And so there are a lot of people in Ukraine who are scared to death about the Russians coming back in there and ruling them like the bad old days.
And in the Baltics and in Poland as well. Well, we hearken back, as we've discussed, to the frightful mass genocide of the 1930s when Stalin murdered between 6 and 7 million Ukrainian peasants. And this folk memory stays. But they're also, look, Eastern Ukraine was part of Russia, very much. It was hardwired into the Russian economy. And I've long said that partition Ukraine, that Western Ukraine, which looks and thinks to Europe, go and let Eastern Ukraine go back and rejoin Russia, mm-hmm. where it really belongs.
Well, and you talked before, too, about the immediate interests of the Eastern Ukrainians to keep out of economic union with Europe because they're protecting their inefficient old industries, but it's still the basis of their local economy, and they like it the way it is, and they certainly can't compete with a bunch of mass-produced crap coming in from the West. But
that's right. All the local factories and mines in Eastern Ukraine would close if they joined Europe. You know, there's another function, too. This isn't addressed as much, and that is that the per capita income of Russians in today's Russia is much higher than in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Ukraine is a failed state. It's been a failed state ever since it's proclaimed independence in 1991. It's been ruled by or misruled by a bunch of totally inept people, infighting, corruption. Behind the scenes are 13 or 14 immensely powerful oligarchs who have bought all the politicians and are looting the wealth out of the country. Ukraine is a mess, and when pro-Western leaders have been running it, it's just been just as bad a mess as when the pro-Russian ones, like that big thug Yanukovych.
Yeah, I saw where, you know, at least in Crimea, they were saying, wow, all the old people's pension just doubled, and military pay just doubled, and a lot of Crimean, you know, Ukrainian Crimeans are thinking, maybe I will join the Russian Navy, if only for a little while, make a little bit of money before I go home.
That's right. That's one of the other problems. This is not just a political question. It's an economic question. And now the Western powers are frantically trying to figure out where to come up with $35 billion to pay off Ukraine's debts. It's bankrupt. It can't pay its gas bills. It owes the Ruskies billions for unpaid gas.
Oh, don't worry. The American people are good for it. We'll bail out the Russians and everybody. Every banker Ukraine owns.
Well, that's what we're doing, and we're just loading more debt onto our already bankrupt debt structure.
It's incredible, really. You know, I saw it was funny, right? The way they talked about it reminded me of Bush going into Iraq, and everybody was shocked when he announced it was going to cost $87 billion, you know, for the first couple of months of operation over there. And everybody was like, $87 billion? In this case, they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to give them $1 billion, $37 billion. And it was there, right, in Bloomberg and whatever financial news. If you look two or three times at Google News, you could find one with the real cost of what the IMF was giving them. And well, in loan guarantees, it's over $30 billion, I think they said.
That's right. And a lot of this is to protect Western financial institutions.
Right, yeah, that's what Ron Paul said. All this money's just going back to New York and London. And
it does, so that they don't default, because otherwise we'd have to admit that the emperor has no clothes in the Ukraine, and that the place is a basket case. The Russians had offered them $15 billion. I wonder if Vlad Putin isn't happy that he said let the Americans take care of Ukraine.
Right. Well, do you think that we can count on Barack Obama being a coward? I mean, sometimes he lives up to being a coward at just the right moment, like Syria last summer, that kind of thing. So maybe even if Putin does push it, which I agree would be stupid, and he's not stupid, but maybe it'd be all right anyway?
It could be all right. You know, Russia has a very capable foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who for whom I have great respect. Putin is a very clever, wise politician. As I wrote a column once saying, you know, Putin is playing chess while Obama's playing checkers over Syria. But the problem is that the plot is thickening now because the American Republicans are involved. They're screaming for war. The Israelis have gotten involved because they have suddenly, we found their very large interests in Ukraine.
You know, I think that's where we're going to have to start this conversation on the other side of this break. It's Eric Margulies, everybody. EricMargulies.com, LouRockwell.com, Uns.com. Back after this. Israel and Ukraine, huh? Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
I love those guys, man. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Eric Margulies, and we're talking about Ukraine. We're fixing to head over to Afghanistan, which is all part of the same big story here. But first of all, Eric, right before we had to go out to that hard break there, you brought up Israel's role in America's Ukraine policy. Is that right? Or at least Israel's role in Ukraine. Tell us about that.
Ukraine has the, I believe, the third largest Jewish population in Europe. And a sizable number of people. It's traditionally the sort of the cradle of the European Jews is in Ukraine. And Israel has been expressing great concern, first over the threats of anti-Semitism coming back. Secondly, a lot of Israelis are outraged over the rise of the extreme right wing in Kiev. So the Israelis are making clear that they don't want to see the Russians come back into Ukraine. When Israel speaks, Congress jumps to attention. So the U.S. Congress is hearing what the Israelis are saying and pro-Israeli influence makers in the states, and it's hardening Congress's position on the Ukraine, certainly bolstering the party that wants to confront Russia over this really formerly totally obscure subject.
Mm-hmm. So I guess they may not like Svoboda and the right sector over there, but they don't fear them enough to want the Russians to come save them yet anyway, huh? And I
not
did read
yet.
In Haaretz that hundreds of Jews, what, 300 or 400 a week, I think they said, are moving back to Israel or to Israel right now.
Well, a lot of the Ukrainian oligarchs, most of whom are Jewish, have, like the Russian oligarchs used to be, have joint Ukrainian-Israeli citizenships. So they fly back and forth. We saw the same phenomenon in Georgia, by the way, when Georgia was confronting the Russia. The Israelis came in, provided them with intelligence and training, and most important, provided them with arms.
All right, so... well, other than the fate of Jewish Ukrainians, they have any other major interests there? I mean, America's big deal is the pipeline routes, right? I mean, overriding concern, and NATO, you know, expansion. But what about the Israelis?
Well, Ukraine plays an important role in producing weapons. It could produce nuclear weapons again, possibly. So the Israelis are just nervous about it. So they regarded Ukraine as an important beachhead for them in Europe, and now they're wondering.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so now here's the thing that nobody ever talks about when it comes to discussions about Russia, and that is that Vladimir Putin was the very first foreign leader to call George Bush after September 11th and say, hey, I'm with you, anything you need, let me know. And then Well, I hope you can report this to me, Eric, or if you know about this. I believe I've read before about how Putin had a real fight inside Russia with politicians and their supporters on his right for supporting the United States and telling George Bush, yes, you can use our former bases in the stands and you can use our invasion routes and supply routes and everything else to invade Afghanistan. And he said, yeah, I mean, it is a real problem opening up the soft underbelly of Russia to the Americans. But on the other hand, I think it's worth it to make friends with them and use this opportunity to really help America out in a way that can, you know, help our relationship move forward. And America's done nothing but accept their gift this whole time. But still, since, you know, at least, what, 2004 or 5, maybe before that, done nothing but spit in their face.
Well, I keep saying that. I've written in column after column. Why are we kicking sand into Russia's face? This is very true. There was strong opposition in Russia to Putin's opening of supply routes into Afghanistan, which brings me to the next point. You know, if we keep confronting the Russians and slapping them in the face, implying sanctions and things like that, Russia is holding 30,000 American troops hostage in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it wasn't completely selfless of Putin to make that allowance, was it? He's sort of got a Trump card over us now, too.
Well, he does, because the southern routes to supply and for exiting U.S. troops from Afghanistan are very, very shaky because of fighting along the Khyber Pass and Malakand Pass in the south. So the main supply and withdrawal route now is the north route, as it's called, which goes all the way to the Caspian and Black Seas and all the way to the Baltic in some cases, uses Russian rail network and Russian airspace. So if Putin puts the screws on there, the Americans are going to be caught in a very frightening situation in Afghanistan.
Well, we can always make peace with Iran and use their routes into Afghanistan, right?
No, that's not going to happen. I don't think it should happen, but it doesn't look like it's going to. Some forces within the U.S. government are going to sabotage that if there's any chance of really a major opening.
Fitz in the chat room says, take my Afghanistan, please.
Yes.
Go ahead. I like the old vaudeville, only funny. By the way, well, we already talked about the Afghan election results there.
We can talk about it again.
Yeah, the last I saw, Abdullah is in the lead, but maybe they'll have to have a runoff. What do you think?
Well, it's totally meaningless. We've already approved the winner. I suspect it's going to be Abdullah, who is half Pashtun but half Tajik, the two major ethnic groups in Afghanistan. He has long been a front man for the Northern Alliance, which is a communist organization, largest drug dealer in Afghanistan. Very tied in with the Soviet and then Russian intelligence services. But it looks like the Americans have decided on him or his rival, Ashraf Ghani. These guys, you know, I was just thinking, watching TV today, anytime you see an Afghan in a very well-tailored suit with his shirt cuffs just peeking out from the sleeves and a perfectly tied knot and speaking blow-dried hair, speaking perfect English, you know, that says CIA Academy all over it.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure the locals are really impressed, right? Wow, what duds. If only he could lead us someday, they say.
They know this whole thing is a fake, this election. And but the Americans probably can't decide who they want. What really disgusts me watching this fake rigged Afghan election, you know, the Russians, the Soviets, when they were there, used to run much more honest elections with real opposition parties. No longer. But it's the American media and the British, the BBC has gotten no better. They're lauding the election and pretending like they're reporting on a real election, when anybody who knows anything about Afghanistan knows that it's not a real election.
Yeah, so, you know, Anand Gopal and Matthew Akins had a piece in Harper's about how, yeah, they have elections in the cities, but not out in the countryside. The whole thing is completely rotten and corrupt,
right.
And in many places it's not even being held at all.
It's a Potemkin village being staged for outsiders.
Man. So, all right, now they've drawn down the surge. They're down from 100 and something thousand back down to 50,000 or so American troops there, right?
Yeah, it's either 30 or 50. I can't remember offhand. But there are a lot of civilian government personnel there, CIA people, AID, the usual, not armed but influential bureaucrats.
I wonder if you think that they're in danger at all of some kind of, fall of Saigon type moment here where the Taliban just says, you guys have been deliberately undercounting us all this time, but now here we are at the gates of Kabul, and you better run like hell because it's your last day occupying this place. And it seems to me like, what's stopping them at this point?
The U.S. Air Force.
Oh, yeah.
America's control of Afghanistan is exercised by air, through the air, by the U.S. Air Force Naval Air Arm. That we run 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, combat air patrols. That means that the bombers and fighters are circling overhead all the time at titanic expense for fuel. The fuel has to be flown in to air bases into Central Asia, probably Manas is the main one. And the minute there's any contact with the Taliban or other resistance groups, the U.S. Air Force is vectored in and attacks and bombs them.
Too hard for them to just infiltrate into Kabul? They set off bombs all the time. They just can't do a real kind of front.
Infiltrating large numbers yet is difficult. The more effective strategy.
Not that I'm cheering for them or anything. I'm just, I'm interested in. It seems like the Americans are being very kind of deliberately ignorant about the position that they're in over there. No.
Well, they don't want to admit that the Taliban is as strong as it is. The Taliban is being cautious because didn't want to irritate the Americans even more. Now that they said they're leaving, they made to change their mind and stay.
Yeah.
So if the Taliban are wise, they'll just let the Americans go and then take over.
Right. Well, let them call it victory. It's fine with me as long as they end the damn thing. Thanks so much for your time again on the show,
You're
Eric.
Welcome,
sure appreciate
Scott.
It.
Cheers.
All right, everybody. That's the great Eric Margulies. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to this dang thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, now, Manning had an appeal. Chelsea Manning had an appeal and was denied the sentence of 35 years in prison was upheld. I don't know if anything else can be done about that or what, but, man, sure hope something else can be done about that. There must be, further stages of appeals. I don't know. But, I think it's the case that if we had a unanimous consensus among the American people that Chelsea Manning's a hero for doing that wonderful thing and leaking all that horrible stuff, then she would be out of prison right now. Thank you very kindly for leaking to us the Afghan and Iraq war logs and the State Department cables and the Guantanamo files. Chelsea, we appreciate it, we all would say. And then, cha-ching, the cell doors would fling wide open, and Chelsea Manning would be free to go. Right? I mean, let's get real. There is no law, not really. They can certainly do whatever they want negative to Chelsea Manning. like, torture him into changing his name to Chelsea. You know? By the way, you know who broke the story of Bradley Manning's torture? Glenn Greenwald. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that's true. That was one of his first hard news pieces that, you know, stories he'd ever broke. I guess there's been a few here and there before Snowden. Mostly he's a journal, you know, columnist. But anyway. They can torture him. They can let him go. And by the way, take some time. Go trolling through the Afghan and Iraq war logs and read some things and see if you learn some things. Go look at those State Department cables for yourself. Go think of some interesting keywords like, a country's name. I wonder what America's relationship with the government of Chad is like, you wonder to yourself. So you type that in, and then you go and see. And get horrified. Holy crap, we pay them to kill who? God dang, that's brutal. Yeah, that's what's like. Great stuff, man. There ought to be bronze statues of Chelsea or Bradley or whoever Manning all over the damn place. And anybody who's confused about that has made a simple conceptual error. Confusing the government of the country with the country. The fact that the government can prosecute you and put you in jail is proof that they are not you. They are them and you are you. If you were them, they couldn't put you in jail. Worst punishment you'd ever get was 2 weeks paid vacation, right? Right. So they're the government. The country's the country. But people get that confused. And they think that somebody like Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden, who's delivering the truth to them, that they may use reason in their democratic processes to improve their society. They see people like that as the enemy. How dare you give me classified information that the government doesn't want me looking at? At least some Americans cry. And really think that. Really internalize that kind of nonsense. Ain't that funny? Well, anyway. I don't know, man. Maybe, I don't know. Chat room guys, what do you think of the odds that Chelsea Manning will ever get out of prison before the 35 years? And I don't mean just basic parole, but I mean politics intervenes, clemency granted, that kind of thing. You think that's even possible? Or just forget it, Horton. Shut up and move on. I don't know. I think what would be funny is if the governor of whatever state Manning is being held in, where, Quantico, where's that? Oh, no, Quantico was before, now Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Wouldn't it be cool if the governor of Kansas just pardoned him? And then, you know, just try it, see what happens, you know. Get in a fight. Try to pretend that the law says that that's all right, even if it's a military prisoner, you know. Make a political thing out of it. Yeah. Something. Somebody save Chelsea Manning. That's all I'm trying to say. All right. Now I got to talk about the Students for Liberty. Now, the Students for Liberty, they had a thing, and the Future Freedom Foundation had a thing at their thing. And then the Future Freedom Foundation invited me to give a talk at their thing at the Students for Liberty's thing. So I got to admit, I'm very grateful. On the other hand, it's a Coke front. And they keep making major errors on issues of foreign policy. And Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com is getting in Twitter wars with some of these people over the horrible things that they write. Oh, yeah, about the military response to the Ukraine crisis that's so necessary right now. And denouncing Ron Paul for being good on Ukraine. And other nonsense like that. And this guy, you know, his response is something, and you know, leave me alone about it, it's no big deal. And Raimondo's answer is, hey, if this lady who's recommending a military response, ow, I bit my tongue. This lady who's recommending a military response to the Ukraine so-called crisis, if she was a member of the KKK or saying something anti-black or anti-feminist or anti-PC on this, that, or the other issue, you would completely freak out. But foreign policy is debatable. And the thing about that is, Justin Raimondo is absolutely right about that. No, foreign policy is not debatable. You are either a frothing-at-the-mouth anti-imperialist or you are not a libertarian, period. And I don't care if you say you are. No, you're not. There's no such thing as a libertarian who does not hate imperialism. And so, yeah, then, you know, Rand Paul and Chris Preble and a lot of these guys, they're not libertarians at all. They're conservatives. A libertarian, by definition, is anti-imperialist. A libertarian, by definition, says U.S. out of the Black Sea permanently, forever, no matter what. There's no room for debate there. You can't be for white supremacy and be a libertarian either. You can't be for Medicaid and be a libertarian either. And you can't be for gun control. And you can't be against gay rights and whatever type of libertarian things make libertarians. And foremost among them all, as important as gun rights or anything else to libertarianism is anti-imperialism. And no, Eastern Europe does not belong to you. Sorry. And no, it's not okay to go around calling yourself a libertarian and being an imperialist. And it is incumbent on all libertarians to attack and destroy anyone who claims to be a libertarian and supports an imperialist foreign policy. And to call them out as the conservatives and liberals that they are. It's as simple as that. The fact that anyone even thinks that's debatable is just ridiculous. In fact, the lady's article about the military response, a student for liberty who wrote about the military response, began the essay with, or the military response part of the essay with, "Now, you know, I know after Iraq and Afghanistan, nobody wants to have a war, but, oh, great. You know what? I've heard that one before, actually." And they didn't used to have to say, "Ever since Iraq and Afghanistan," just that's more obvious now. It used to just be, in fact, I even made a bumper sticker out of this. It used to just be, "Well, nobody's pro-war. It's just that in this case, oh, no, we all hate war. It's just that I want this war." And, you know, what's hilarious about this, too, is this person from the Students for Liberty who wrote this essay for the Daily Caller, which is a, you know, right-wing rag anyway. It says at the bottom of the page, she's from Latvia or Estonia or this, that, the other thing. Oh, not that she has a vested interest in what Russia's doing over there. I guess we ought to let the Latvian Americans decide whether we should have a war with Russia over Ukraine, huh? Or maybe not. Oh yes, liberty-minded people must be concerned about the liberty of the Eastern Ukrainians. No. Well, I mean, in spirit, sure. But as a mandate to the U.S. government? Are you kidding me? Get the hell out of here. That doesn't even make me mad. That's just stupid and ridiculous. Give me a break. How can someone call themselves a libertarian and then be worse on foreign policy than X number of so many liberals and conservatives who are better on this than you? Give me a break. Anyway. So, good for Raimondo. I like it when he writes articles about how horrible people are on the things that they're horrible on, and I hope that his war against Students for Liberty continues, because they deserve that. Oh, and man, did you guys see, speaking of antiwar.com, did you see the new Nick Turse piece on antiwar.com today? Where the hell is this thing? Man, I'm sick. I can feel something's got me. Germs, man, they got me. Where the hell did it go? Oh, man, here. AFRICOM becomes a war-fighting combatant command. By Nick Turse and Tom Englehart. Originally posted at Tom Dispatch. Running today at antiwar.com. And, well, there's this sort of partner article with it here, just incidentally, from Reuters. Nigerian bus station bombing kills 71 on the edge of the capital, Islamists suspected. And so, you know, I don't know exactly who's behind the bombing. I suppose it's plausible enough that Boko Haram is behind it. And what's funny is that America really has no military interest in Nigeria other than, I guess, backing the government there more than they already do. But their access, American corporations and their access to Nigerian oil resources are not in question. You know, the rebels from, you know, back in 07 who were threatening that, they've all been defeated long ago. And these Boko Haram guys, you know, as far as I can tell, they, you know, they've never really been able to threaten any oil interests or resources there. And the government is a very Western loyal, American loyal government. They work with Shell Oil, most of all, I believe, there. And do what they're told. Steal the oil right out from under the local villagers and give them none of the money and ruin their land and move on to the next one. And all of that. But you know what? Those special forces job holders, these fat ass JSOC guys, who just want to sit around killing people all day instead of having to get a real job. They're worse than all the goons sucking tax money all day down at the Department of Transportation. Get a job, guys. But no, we're just going to go around murdering Africans all day. The pay is good. It's American tax money. There's an unlimited supply of it, apparently. Well, and Janet Yellen can print the rest. And it's just another excuse to get further involved in Africa. And I'm telling you, go read Nick Turse today about America's full-scale invasion of the Dark Continent. It's brutal, man. It's going to be brutal for a long time to come.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Again, congratulations to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and Yo McCaskill and Barton Gellman. But especially Glenn. Congratulations on winning the goddamn Pulitzer Prize, man. That's really something else. He certainly deserves it. And, you know, for the millionth time, I can't imagine Edward Snowden making a better choice for who to leak that stuff to than Glenn Greenwald. And it was smart of him to give it to Barton Gellman, too, because Gellman, he's at the Post, but he's the best guy at the Post. So he's going to do good work, but also he's at the Post. So, you know, and you see how hard they've tried to work to smear Greenwald and make a criminal out of him and all this stuff, and Poitras, too, although she's not as prominent as Glenn. And she's not as dangerous of a TV interview as Glenn is. But it's been really hard to criminalize Greenwald's journalism when the obvious answer, the obvious question is right there. For any lawyer, for any judge, for any honest media person, well, what about Barton Gellman? What about everybody at ProPublica and the New York Times and everyone else at The Guardian who's worked on these stories too? This is journalism. This isn't espionage, so just shut up about it. The fact, and Greenwald was smart to go around and partner up with these journalists all over the country, too, and make sure that, you know, hey, Laura, you know, it'd be a good idea. Why don't you go write some pieces with Mazzetti and Risen over and Savage over at the New York Times? Get them, you know, up to their necks in this stuff. I mean, it's not like the government ever had a legitimate case, but he certainly, you know, Greenwald certainly set up the argument well. So that, you know, Mike Rogers can howl in the wind, but nobody's buying it. Nobody thinks that this administration or the next one is going to criminalize the New York Times doing reporting. And if they can't prosecute, well, I guess they can prosecute you for not revealing your sources, but Ed Snowden already came clean, so that's what they have on Ryzen. I don't know. They can't prosecute the New York Times and the Washington Post and them for espionage. Or they can, but at that point, just take the flag down off the pole. This ain't the USA no more. Forget it. And you know what? They already changed it to the homeland quite a while ago now. And I don't know. But anyway, now what are they going to do about it? Now he's the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. And by the way, chat room guys, tell me. I think some of y'all joined late. Do you think it's right? Does it look to you like they awarded the Pulitzer Prize to The Guardian and The Post, but not specifically the 3-4 reporters involved? And then is that what it sounds like to me, that they just want to deny Greenwald the right to claim that he's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter? Oh no, he just, you know, was the lead reporter for the newspaper that won the prize. Because if that's true, that's going to really piss me off, you know? That may just be what it looks like at first glance because of lousy headline writing and so forth. I don't know. Sometimes headline writers really suck, so. I am just not sure. I don't know. I think I'm doing pretty good for having a fever this whole time. I mean, I can see straight. I'm not, you know, I'm like 100, right? I'm not like 101 or 2 or 3 or anything crazy. Just, I'm at like 100 right now. Maybe like 99 point. High 99s, anyway. Somewhere there, 99.7 maybe, 99.9. But, you know, after the show, I'm going to drink a bunch of cold water. Maybe splash some on my face. I think that's going to be nice. I'm looking forward to that. I think I'm going to gargle with warm salt water, too. All right. More important things to talk about. Oh, God dang it, Bobby. I was going to ask Eric Margolis about this Gaddafi movie. Did you see the Gaddafi movie on Showtime? So they had this Gaddafi movie, and it's like, come on, man. It's so heavy-handed. And the guy is a son of a bitch, right? He's a dictator of a crappy third-world country. He walks around in a dress and a general's uniform at the same damn time. And I guess I heard it enough times in enough different places now that maybe I'm buying the fact that he consistently raped young girls that he would, you know, have his government pick from the surrounding schools near his house and have his way with them whenever he felt like it, and that he was the, you know, he was a sick bastard, you know? The mad dog Gaddafi. But man, this movie, oh, it all starts out with, yeah, he wanted to rule the world. He was going to be the king of all Africa. And oh, man, they had a really cool stock footage of a hydrogen bomb going off. Oh, he was going to make nukes. Here's some footage of what nukes look like. Oh, my God, Gaddafi's scary. And yet, by the end of the movie, they have to admit, and they're still, it's still negative on him, so it's okay kind of for them to admit that actually Gaddafi was a pathetic joke. I mean, he was a horrible monster to live under. But as far as an international threat, come on. Even when he went around touring, as they say, he went touring around Africa trying to create the United States of Africa and this and that. And they were just lining up for handouts, all the other different governments of Africa, saying, sure, pay us, go ahead. Oh yeah, we'll go along with whatever you want. But it was all a stupid stunt anyway, and he's a joke. Always was a joke. So, he was a monster, but he was a really little monster. Certainly as far as an international threat, and certainly since, you know, at least the early 90s. And the way they told the story about how, this nuclear weapons program, that the war in Iraq followed by the threat that you're next, pal, is what really scared him into giving up his nuclear weapons program and all this. Nonsense. he bought all that junk from AQ Khan's garage sale, which was all still sitting in crates and warehouses. He had no spinning centrifuges. There was no enrichment program up and going in Libya at all. It was just sitting there. He only bought that crap so he had something to trade. In this case, he was able to hand George W. Bush a great publicity stunt, which may have worked on you if you remember back at the time. Were you one of the sock puppets of the Republican Party who repeated the Mina Bird talking point they implanted in your brain that, well, the Iraq War made Gaddafi give up all his stuff and made him become a good guy now because of what? Because of the Iraq? Because that was their talking point. They were desperate to come up with a single positive effect of the invasion of Iraq, and so that was their little publicity stunt that lasted a week, was the Iraq War scared Gaddafi into coming clean. Well, come on. You know, Gary Hart wrote an article, the former senator wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine in, like, what, 99 or 2000? Or no, maybe it was later than that. But anyway, it was about how Gaddafi had sent somebody to come and meet with him in Athens, Greece, and beg forgiveness and to be brought back in from the cold. And whatever I have to do, I want to be friends with you. And they wouldn't accept him. But he'd been, you know, begging to suck up and to quit being a rogue state forever. And in fact, they even talk about in there about how it's funny, the lack of irony, the way they talk about it. Well, yeah, you know, the Americans, they hired these Mujahideen guys who tried to kill Gaddafi, but it didn't work that well. So we moved the Mujahideen guys to Virginia or wherever and kept them all this time. And then all of a sudden the Mujahideen went to war with us with September 11th and then the whole war on terror after that and all of this and fighting against the Mujahideen in Iraq. And then after that, America decided to get rid of Gaddafi after all, and they barely even talk about, it's funny the way they skip it, they barely sort of talk about how this was a NATO war. I mean, they make it seem like it was just an Arab Spring uprising. They barely mention the influence of Western air power at all. I don't know if they do mention Western air power or special forces being involved at all, because they try to focus just on Gaddafi, but to the exclusion of who overthrew him, and they make it sound like it was just, as Eric Margulies just said, like made it sound like it was a natural uprising rather than a U.S.-sponsored CIA coup d'etat overthrow, you know, a la Iran 1953, which is what it really was. And, and anyway, so, you know what? I think I had a couple more points about the Gaddafi movie. What were they? It was mostly a bunch of crap. You know what it was? Mostly it was an after-the-fact rationalization for the American war there. Like, well, he was a real bad guy. Yeah, compared to what? Compared to the anti-black pogroms that took place in Libya, maybe are still taking place in Libya. Nobody's covering it. Nobody cares enough to cover it anymore. But Barack Obama basically put the KKK in power in Libya. It turned into an Arab versus black African war quickly. And real horrible atrocities. Our friend David Enders from McClatchy Newspapers reported from Libya about, I think he was on the phone from Libya at the time, talking about the mass rapes taking place in the refugee camps and all this stuff against the black Africans who, you know, the rumor was since Gaddafi had hired some Tuaregs to be his, who are like only, they're like, I don't know, half Berber, half black African, something like that. I don't know. Something like that. And since he had hired them to be his mercs, well, then that means all blacks in Libya are Gaddafi's mercs. Oh, yeah, great. These idiots. And that became the basis of horrible racial pogroms there. And then, of course, the rat line of all of Gaddafi's weapons to the Mujahideen war in Syria. The disaster still playing out. In fact, keep that, you know, low, because if they admit how bad it is, they might intervene worse over there. I don't know. All right, thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.